Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
You have a brother in the 2nd Battalion.
Yes, sir.
They're walking into a trap. Your orders are to deliver a message calling off tomorrow's attack. If you fail, we will lose 1,600 men, your brother among them.
We need to keep moving! Come on!
There is only one way this war ends.
No! No, no!
Last man standing.
Sheesh, that's intense. Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets in the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am here with my host, Spencer Williams. How going, Spence?
Hey.
We are joined by Video Game Bang's Emma Skies. How's it going, Emma?
It's good. It's good.
The first time having you on the show
it
ever.
It is. I'm here to ruin your show.
She is. She's actually stated that previously on Video Game Bang, so keep an eye on her.
And you still had her on?
You still invited me.
I mean, hey, you know, it was a good movie. What am I supposed to say? We got a great show in store for you, as obviously we're going to be talking about 1917. So stick around as we dive into that. But before we do, Spence, give them a little bit of them opening credits.
At the height of the First World War, two young British soldiers, Schofield and Blake, are given a seemingly impossible mission. In a race against time, they must cross enemy territories and deliver a message that will stop a deadly attack on hundreds of soldiers, Blake's own brother among them.
Directed and co-written and produced by Sam Mendes, the film stars George MacKay, Dean Charles Chapman, Mark Strong, Andrew Scott, Richard Madden of Game of Thrones, Claire DeBoerck, I don't know how that's pronounced, Colin Firth, and Benedict Cumberbatch. Inspired by his grandfather's experience in World War I, the autobiography of Alfred H. Mendes, 1897-1991, this is Sam Mendes' second war film. His first was Jarhead back in 2005. I don't know if you guys had even seen Jarhead.
I haven't thought about that movie in 10 years.
That movie was really interesting. I don't know if I'd call it a war flick. Didn't really have any war in it,
mm-hmm.
But I mean, hey, to each his own. Spence, have you seen Jarhead?
I saw the poster.
Well, there you go.
That's almost as good.
Right? Just another little quick piece. The film was shot and edited to appear as a single long take that takes place in real time with almost no breaks. This is an interesting aspect of the film because, in all honesty, it does feel like a singular long take. I know Emma, who was a big fan of the film.
So good.
Posted on Twitter about how she absolutely loved it. And so we had to bring her on the show so that we could dig into this film because of the fact that I fell asleep on this film, to be quite honest.
What?
Like before, like when it first came out, when we first started hearing about it, I was like, well, I don't know if I want to see this. I don't know if I want to see another war epic. I was like,
that's how I was.
I even told Spence, I'm like, I'm not really looking forward to it. It is what it is, blah, blah, blah. And then we actually go and get a chance to see the dang thing, and I'm like, I feel like a jerk for like waiting on this, because had there been an opportunity to check it out at like a press screening, I probably should have jumped on it, but I feel like a dope.
I was pretty apathetic to it too, for the same thing. I'm like, oh, cool, another war movie. Awesome. And I honestly, I didn't even know going into it how it was shot. Like,
yeah,
I didn't know
here.
Any of that. And I know that was, like, a big part of promoting it. I had no idea. I was just like, cool, another war movie. But it's got some actors that I like, and I got nothing going on tonight. So, may as
right.
well.
And that's the really interesting part about it. This is one of those films that you get glimpses of really well-known people like Mark Strong. Everybody knows Richard Madden, like I said, from Game of Thrones. Benedict Cumberbatch, Doctor Strange. Colin Firth from his stuff in his rom-coms back in the day. And then now with his... what is that, Kingsman movies. There were so many great things to see in this that I actually had to go back through the IMDb page. I'm like, did I miss anybody? Who did I miss?
I'm saying they all had about 5 seconds of dialogue.
Exactly. Everybody was like, boom, 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 boom. I'm like, I bet Beyonce was somewhere in there. I bet Beyonce had a cameo.
She's down in the trenches.
I knew it. See? But this movie was so unique, and it was something that I honestly am glad we got a chance to see. I'm surprised it took us this long, but... We needed to talk about it tonight, so we're going to dive into this movie. This is going to be a spoiler-filled review because, in all honesty, it's history. So
that's what I said. Somebody talked, like, bitched about getting a spoiler. I was like, can you get historical events spoiled?
Like, there are books on this stuff. There's, you know, actual... I just mentioned the autobiography of Alfred H. Mendez. I mean, you can go ahead and check that out. So we're going to be bringing out the spoilers. We're going to be talking about it all. So, Spence, are you ready?
Yeah.
Emma, you ready?
Very.
All right. First things first, I want to talk about expectations. I know we've kind of touched on a little bit of those, but I think in all honesty, my biggest expectation out of this was I sincerely thought this was just going to be another war movie.
Yep.
Like, I honestly walked into this movie and I'm like, all right, there's going to be blood and guts. We're going to see, you know, sausages and, like, the red syrup all over the place. And people are going to be, like, yelling for their mom. And just everything that we've seen overly done, like, in every other war film. I'm to be honest, I was kind of glad for that whole era of time where we hadn't had a war flick. Like, there'd been, like, at least a few years since the last one, at least to my recollection. I don't know about you guys.
World War One movies are generally less popular than World War Two movies anyway.
Yeah, because so it's always, like, behind-the-scenes
stuff. Yeah.
It's always like, oh, hello, Chop. Why don't we fix this machine and do whatever? I don't know.
Clearly.
I'd see that movie. I would go see that movie.
Exactly, see? But it didn't seem to interest me. Like, the idea of just two guys going on this trip, I'm like, I've seen Homeward Bound. I know what it's like going back home. So I don't need to see a movie about two people that are lost trying to find their way to somewhere else. Disney does a really great job of doing that. So
I just wanted to know what Tommen Lannister's up to these days.
Exactly. I really wanted to make sure that if I was going to see this film, my biggest expectation was to just be awake through the whole thing. I thought I was going to sleep.
Putting that bar real high.
I know, right? There's this is honestly the biggest expectation for it because, like I said, I don't like war movies. I don't think, personally, I'm not a fan of war. So I don't really know how.
Controversial opinion right there.
Right? I mean, there's some of those people out there who just really, really thrive on it and just cash in on that. But what about you, Spence? I know you came in and you were about as apprehensive as I was to see this film.
I was mostly interested in the long takes because I heard about that. And then
why didn't you tell me?
Well, I thought you heard about it. You normally tell me about things. Why would I tell you about anything?
Because I didn't know jack about what was going on. I was like, oh.
Are you glad you didn't know, though? Like, was it cool to figure out on the fly as it was happening?
You know, actually, to an extent, it was cool as we were watching. I'm like, huh, they haven't really cut here. Huh. How long is this?
Wait, you didn't know when we were in the theaters that?
I didn't know.
That was the main reason I was going.
Why didn't you tell me that? Are you going to relay that to me and be like...
Because you're the one who's always telling me... whatever. Anyway, yes, this is the main reason why I wanted to go. Otherwise, I would have protested this movie. And I mostly wanted to see how they were going to do the real-time aspect for the most part. Because I was like, there's no way that these people are driving anywhere because that's just not going to work.
Yeah. I really... Like I said, I had no clue. In all honesty, I fell, and when I say I fell asleep, I didn't mean I fell asleep in the actual theater. Sheesh. Like, I fell asleep in terms of, like, I'm not going to look much into this. I don't really care for it. I'm pretty sure everybody's just overhyping it because they're like, oh, this deserves an Oscar, and this deserves
just total Oscar bait.
Exactly. Yeah. It felt like that because, honestly, after what we've been seeing and hearing about Oscar-worthy films, with air quotes, I had already written off 2019 for the movies. Like, I'm like, I'm done with 2019. I'm cool. Endgame was at the beginning of the year. I'm cool. Just move on to the next thing. But to be honest, this was one of those ones that just kind of took me by surprise. Emma, what about you? What were some of your expectations coming in right before the film?
Literally nothing. All I knew was the cast, and I was like, I like all these names. And then I didn't see any of them on screen, and I didn't care. I liked all the names. I knew that visually it was going to be a pretty movie as much as, like, a war movie can be. Like, it was going to be a beautiful film because between Roger Deakins and Sam Mendes, I was like, it's going to look good. So at least it'll be aesthetically pleasing for whatever that's worth. And it was really just, I got nothing going on for the next couple hours. Let's fill some time. And then it was phenomenal.
Yeah. And that goes into, like, just the first impressions after the theater, like, walking out, to be honest, once we saw the film, I really was kind of like shell-shocked. I was in a place where I was like, oh my God, this literally just happened. Like, we saw this film, and it feels like you're along for the ride the way the film is shot. And I felt almost exhausted walking out because I'm like,
it's because you're tense the whole time.
Exactly.
It's like all your muscles are tense, so you're physically tired when you leave.
Like, I felt like I was tearing apart the seat that I was sitting in because my fingers kept digging into the plush on the side. It was extremely nerve-wracking from beginning to end, and I couldn't look away.
That first one that gets you is the hand thing, and then it just never stops.
Oh.
Our whole theater had an audible reaction. Everybody in the theater went, oh no.
Yeah, this movie, so needless to say, this movie had me thinking one way. Like, I actually thought at the beginning of the film, within the first 15 minutes, I'm like, all right, I know where this film's gonna go, I'm good, all right, I know what's gonna happen here. And then it shakes you up like in an instant. And you find yourself stuck in this place of like, I don't know how I feel about this. I'm watching this and I'm seeing all these things and I'm like, yeah, it did the most.
Well, they shoot the first 15, 20 minutes to make you like, so you know who the main character is, and then he's not.
Yeah. And that was probably for me the biggest shakeup. Like, it wasn't even an obvious thing. So obviously, like we said, spoilers galore, whatever, but jumping right into this, like, I was really surprised the turn of how this film went after like that 15-20 minute mark. And because this is about a 2-hour movie, it's an hour and 59 minutes, and about 15-20 minutes into it, who you thought was going to be making it to the very end, he's gone. Like,
it was horrible too.
It was a trip, because I thought the guy, so it's two guys who are being sent on this mission, and one of these guys seems to be fumbling all over the place. He gets a barbed wire through his hand. He gets his hand that has that deep barbed wire cut stuck through a dead body's chest.
Oh, God.
Chest.
That, I hate it.
And
I don't like it.
You're like, oh, he's definitely gone. Like,
yep.
Gangrene or something's going to get him. Like, he's going to get the fever or something. I don't know what was going on during World War One. Like, what, scarlet pox? Measles? I don't know.
That's what gets you, the scarlet pox measles.
See, Spence? They're going to be like that.
It's coming back now that the anti-vax movement's going where it's going.
There you go, anti-vaxxers. Unite.
Don't ever say that again. I can never be back. I'm going to go.
But the dynamic of this film really chooses to utilize that one-take vision, that one-take impression in the film to really jar you and make things always on edge. It never seems like you're looking from the outside in. It always feels like you're looking from the inside, first person perspective of everything. And I think that's what scares you the most. What do you think, Spence?
I think the best part about this movie is the main character twist.
Yeah.
Yep.
Because especially there's a scene where they're going through like a bunker and a rat hits a tripwire and explodes, and the person who you think's gonna die is alive. And then that was the part where
how
I was like,
how did he not die?
Yeah, I was like, something's up here, because there's no way that he should have lived through that, since he was way closer and under rubble.
And under rocks?
He moves a rock off his face and his face is perfect.
yeah, it didn't make any sense. But yeah, that was a good twist right there, though.
I really think the idea of what it was doing, utilizing, like I said, that long take, that first person perspective throughout this entire film, I really think that added a lot to the nervousness of the film, because of the fact that, especially in that scene, it never feels like it's just two people. It always feels like it's those two people and you're like this third person following behind. Like, you're just like going along with the mission. And it's crazy, because even when that scene happened, I actually freaked out. Like, when the bomb went off, I didn't expect it to jar me that much out of my seat. And I'm not a big person like who likes to jump out of seats or whatever. I love horror movies. However, this scared the crap out of me, like, plain and simple. And it was because of the fact that I'm looking and I'm all intense, like, right next to, I feel like I was right next to the guy that was looking at it, like, oh, there's tripwire, whatever. And then boom, and then everything goes off.
Well, and that scene gives you just enough time to register what it is and, like, keep track of it and be like, okay, so I know if something hits this, it's going to go off. And then when, you know, kind of lulls you, like, oh, we know it's there. Okay, we're going to turn around. And then it hits it.
Yeah.
And you have no time to, like, tense up for it or get ready for it. And it just happens.
And I think there's a lot of relatability with, so the two main characters, Dean Charles Chapman and George McKay, Dean Charles Chapman being the brother of the individual who's out in the field, who's about to be marched into to his death. There's a lot to say about their performances because of the fact that Dean Charles Chapman sincerely in this film felt like everybody something that everybody else would have done in terms of if it was their family member, like, oh, heck yeah. If someone told me my brother was about to be marched to his death, I would be like straight going, like no holds bar, just walking into whatever hellstorm just to make sure I could get to him. And that's exactly what he portrays in this film. I think it's beautifully done for the short time he is in the film. It's beautifully done, and it relates really easily to the viewer, to the people who are watching. And George McKay on the other side plays the more logical yet seasoned. It almost felt like he was a little bit more experienced in war than the other one, maybe not by much.
It feels like when they start out, like he is taking care of Blake.
Yeah.
Because even that scene with his hand, like he moves the barbed wire for Blake and then lets him pass. And as he's going through, hurts himself. And there was another part where like he picked something up to carry something for him. And it felt like he was going to carry this kid through the entire way. Like he was the big brother there.
And it felt like within that dynamic, the film paints this picture like he's so invested in taking care of him that he's going to be willing to take a bullet for him.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's the intention they give you right from the get-go. And when that transition happens about 15, 20 minutes in, you're like, whoa, like I did not expect that to come down that way. And it takes you by surprise because the way the whole scene falls out is, you know, they're trying to save somebody of the other side, the enemy. They're trying to save them from getting burned up in an airplane that goes down, and one steps away for 2 seconds. And this is what I told Spencer when we left. I told him the worst part about that scene was not for the fact that he ends up getting killed, but there's no like indication that it's happening the way we're used to.
Yeah.
Like you're used to like in films and in most movies, even cartoons, whatever else is out there in whatever medium, when somebody's about to die, they're usually screaming, no, don't kill me. Or it seems like the more logical things that you would hear in film logic.
Mm-hmm.
In this one, you hear more of like the disdain of the fact that like this is going to inconvenience me. Like, no. It's like you don't hear the screams or the cries. You hear like,
I got shit to do.
Exactly.
I don't have time for this. And I don't have time to die right now.
Exactly. And it was like that whole scene painted it like, oh, well, okay, he's probably going to be okay, and that's why he's running. But then you come to find out he's got like he's gushing blood out of this hole in his body.
The thing that got me about that is I was so certain. I was like, all right, there's a bunch of metal from this plane and everything's on fire. They're just going to cauterize the wound. That's just how this is going to go. It's going to be super gross. I'm going to have to watch them cauterize it. They're going to patch him up and he'll go. I did not expect him to bleed out.
Yeah, that was surprising.
Remind me to take Emma with us next time we go on a trip.
I don't understand why they didn't cauterize the wound. There's fire everywhere. I'm just saying.
No, and it's one of those moments where you're like, even when you're watching it, like for me, I was like, I don't know what to do right now. Like I'm watching somebody slowly slip away, and it's difficult to process because you're like, this is actually happening. Like this is really happening, and you were expecting to see this character make it all the way to the end of this 2-hour film, and it sucks because you know this guy has a brother. He's got a brother that's out there in the field, and there's so much precedence that happens right before that scene that is building up this character to be somebody of note, like, oh, his vast experience in flora and his information he has here and he's like a cartographer. He's really good with maps, and they're really building him up. And the way that twist just happens is like just reaches into your chest and pulls out your heart, and it's like, darn you, Sam Mendes, and your wonderful storytelling. But that changes up the whole film for like where it goes to from there, which I don't know about you guys. Did you guys see The Mist?
No.
Not in a very long time.
I was getting a lot of that vibe when at the end of The Mist, when Thomas Jane's character uses the remaining bullets to kill everyone else, and spoiler alert, kill everyone else in the car because the mist is coming, and usually the creatures are in the mist, and to save them from the horrors that's coming in the mist, he ends up letting them, he kills everybody else to save them from that, and he himself faces the horror that's left. Comes to find out that it's actually the military that's coming. They've actually been defeating back the monsters, and everybody's getting saved. And for me, I felt like the moment that Blake's, you know, character, when he actually passes, and then you see the soldiers, I'm like, where the heck were you guys like 15, 20 seconds earlier?
Cars, how did we not hear them coming? It's 1917. That is not a Tesla. It's not silent.
Those cars sound like train engines going down the road. Where was the noise? That bothered me. Like, honestly, it bothered me.
That was, I think, the only thing about the movie that really took me out of the moment. Was like, that's one of those very convenient movie moments of like, oh, they're here and you had no idea. It's like, no, you would have heard them coming.
Yeah.
It just,
and they would have heard the gunshot.
Yeah.
Wait, what gunshot?
Wait, no, it was a knife.
Because
when he shoots him.
Yeah, Schofield shoots the German soldier.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you would have thought like, oh, they would have rushed over there. It just, that kind of frustrated me because I'm like, he could have lived.
Yeah.
That could have been so like avoided. It was dumb.
His death scene, though, was crazy. Because, I mean, just like the how drawn, like you're watching somebody bleed out in real time in a single shot because that's just the way that they did this. And he has to die in a single shot. And then usually when you're playing a dead character, there's cuts and things. So it's like, all right, hold your breath. Okay, cut. We'll come back to it. Hold your breath. He had to like pretend to be dead for a good 4 or 5 minutes.
Yep.
Yeah. I was like, is he breathing? I'm like watching the actor, like, is his chest moving? Can I see his pulse in his neck? He was,
like, are his fingers moving? Did he twitch his foot? Just watch him. Just watch him. And then the film just kind of kicks it into high gear from that moment forward. Like, you have McKay's character, Schofield, just going to town in terms of knowing this is what he's got to do. He's going to honor his fallen brother. He's going to go and fulfill this mission. And it gets intense from that moment forward. I mean, you have him going through enemy territory. You have him having this standoff with this sniper. And the whole film from that point forward is just a lesson in the beauty that is the long take. Because from that point, there's a scene where he ends up like falling back and gets knocked out. And we have our first real cut in the film. Or not real, because to be honest,
noticeable
cut. But this film thrives on the mindset that it's all in one entire take. And for it to be able to pull it off to where the uneducated eye, you know, people other than us three here in the room, the untrained eye, you're not really able to see it. But this film feels like it's just one long standing like scene, one right after another, and it's ridiculous, because thinking of like what people were actually going through back in the day and seeing this all happen was pretty trippy. But the idea of what the long take is, it's such a beautiful thing. And interestingly enough, nowadays we see it a little bit more often in film. We see it a little bit more in certain cinemas and even TV shows. I was thinking about it the other day after we saw it. Daredevil season one.
Yes.
Has that one scene where he's fighting in the hallway, and that's a continuous one long take, one right after another. There's no cuts. It's one single take done over a longer period of time. And most people are wondering, like, what is a long take? Like, you may be wondering, well, is just a continuous shot one long take? Like, if it's one scene and it just takes really long, is that a long take? Like, no, that's not a long take. A long take is technically a shot lasting much longer than the conventional editing pace, either of the film itself or films in general, and it's usually done with one singular camera. So that's kind of the defining factor for it. Some people are looking at it like, oh, well, my favorite Chuck Norris movie has a long take because he fights everybody in the bar with the pool stick. No, that's not a long take. I'm looking at you, Spence.
Okay.
But, I mean, there's a lot of great instances of like really good usages of the long take. Recently, within the last few years, we had Birdman which I don't know if you guys got a
chance to see that one.
Birdman is a really great example of like great long take usage. However, it does utilize a lot of the same techniques that they use in this film with Sam Mendes in terms of finding really unique ways to create those splits. There is a film that was back in 2002 called Russian Ark, hour and 39 minutes, no CGI, no cuts. The whole film is one long take.
Good God.
And it's insane. I've actually had a chance to see it, not recently, but I saw it like sometime a year ago. And the movie, it's beautiful. And there's a whole documentary on the making of it, how everybody has to move from like room to room in the backdrop to like make sure they set up everybody as they're following this composer going through this. It's like a cathedral.
Mm-hmm.
And they're watching him, and it's kind of like on a holy day or whatever, and this composer's trying to get this thing done and whatever. But an hour and 39 minutes of one continuous take, they were saying in the documentary that anytime anybody would mess up, they would have to go back to the beginning.
Yeah. Can you imagine getting like an hour and 20 minutes in and somebody messes up?
Like, all right, get the bats, where everybody gets one hit. Because it's insane. And to find that we're seeing it now more and more, it kind of begs to ask the question, like, are we overusing the long take? Like, is the long take getting, like, overly used and overly done? Like, to be honest, one of my dirty pleasure films, like, one of my guilty pleasure films is...
it's a very different category.
Yeah, no joke. My guilty pleasures... is Kung Fury on YouTube. I don't know if you guys have seen it.
Oh yeah.
No.
It's a ridiculous movie. Like like homage to like all things 80s. But there's a scene in it where the main guy, so he's a cop who's imbued with the powers of karate.
Yes.
I like that he's not a cop that does karate. He's imbued with the powers.
Exactly.
Of karate.
Cuz he gets struck by lightning something.
Oh, there it is.
and he becomes like this incredible martial artist who ends up finding a way to go back in time.
What?
To the dinosaur ages where he meets Thor.
What?
As they're riding on dinosaurs.
How does this keep getting worse?
Oh, no, it's lasers. Getting better all the time. This, oh no, the laser raptors.
Oh, and then the laser raptors.
Oh, my God.
And he finds a way, Thor finds a way
to... Why did we not talk about this movie? This movie is fantastic.
Thor finds a way to send him to the future to stop Hitler from coming to the future and taking over the world.
Yeah.
And so the long take happens when they make it to a...
I forgot what we were talking about.
We're talking about the long take. This is long route to get to the long take. But essentially, the long take in that film is a scene where he's fighting a bunch of Nazis in one singular succession. But it's so CGI-laden. I love the movie. But things like that seem to be more and more prevalent in films in terms of the long take. So my question to you guys is, what do you guys think in terms of, like, are we overutilizing the long take? Is it just getting kind of used by everybody nowadays?
I think bringing up Daredevil and the one that they did is actually a very good point for this, because have you seen all three seasons of Daredevil?
I haven't seen the last season.
So they do that in all three seasons, because the first one was such a hit that they came out with season two and they're like, okay, well, we have to do it again, and you have to make it better. So there's another long shot take in season two, and it's the elevator, stairwell. The one in season three is, I want to say, almost 15 minutes long.
Are you serious?
And it's got fights, it's got dialogue, they're moving. They go from inside the prison to outside the prison. It's basically getting him out of a prison that he's visiting. And it's almost 15 minutes long, I want to say. And that was the one where I was like, okay, I get it. You had a gimmick and it worked really well and it was super fucking cool. It's a little played out now and this is a little bit awkward. Hmm. Like, this scene honestly would have looked better if you hadn't done it this way, because there's so many times where they have to switch in and out of his stunt double and you can severely tell when that change happens. And it's like, oh, I haven't seen your face for 2 minutes. You're not Charlie Cox. You're the stunt double. Hmm.
Yeah.
But if you'd just done cuts and didn't feel like you had to do this 15-minute scene like this, then it would have looked a lot better.
And that's the kind of thing that I'm like, I don't want this to become like a gimmick where everybody keeps trying to do it but they do it poorly in certain aspects. Like season one,
so good,
is really such great. A masterful scene. Like, it's so beautiful the way it's done,
and it's a huge homage to Old Boy, which also did it really, really well.
Yeah, exactly, and exactly. Old Boy is one of those films that, like, you recognize that long take. And it's completely just one long hallway, and you're seeing it from side perspective, but it's beautiful the way the whole thing pans out. And that scene does it really well. It honors it very well. But after the fact, like, I feel like we're getting to a place. Do you guys feel like we're getting to a place to where everybody's like, oh, I want to do a film, and I want to put a long take in it because I want people to notice it, and blah, 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 blah. Like,
I bet this triggers even more of it. I bet after 1917, we see it even more.
You really think so?
Yeah, because it's going to do, it did it so well, and it's going to win a bunch of awards, and it's going to get a whole lot of praise, and it's going to be one of those things that, like, I bet 20 years down the line, we're going to see a movie that has, you know, a bunch of long takes, and they're like, well, this is really an homage to 1917, which I saw when I was, you know, however many years old. Like, this is going to be a thing. It's not going away.
Yeah, and that sucks, because it's like, I don't want it to, but, and the biggest problem, the biggest place we're going to be seeing it probably pop up is in, like, action movies, like fight scenes.
Which is the hardest thing to do.
Exactly. And because, just like you said, you have to incorporate not only your stunt doubles, but you have to incorporate all the people that are in there, choreography to work right. You have to have people to actually look like they're taking hits and not just drop to the floor. I mean, we've seen that done several times over with multiple, like, shots. Batman, what is that? The Dark Knight Rises. Mm-hmm. There's a whole scene where Catwoman's fighting someone and someone just flips over without even getting hit. So it's out there. It's prevalent. I just really hope that the opportunities like with this, with Roger Deakins, what he's done with this film and this particular homage to the long take, because if you think about it, some of the best films that are out there, some of those best scenes that have the long take that's done properly, it really just emotes like this sense of raw reality and authenticity in the scene. And for me, bastardizing it, I guess, is the best way to put it. Doing that will ultimately cause this beautiful art form to just turn into like some pop culture reference for everybody to be able to insert into their films. And I don't want that to become the norm.
I think drama lends itself a lot more to long takes than action does.
Yeah.
Even though action tries to do it. Did you either of you watch The Haunting of Hill House?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so episode 6 has that super long starting shot. And, like, they're moving actors in and out of the scene. Like, they do a camera pan where it's all the actors. That's and when it pans right. back, it's different people. Like, they did it really well. Drama works really well for it.
Do you guys think that that's where the transition is going to happen? That's where it's going to primarily, like, find its forte? With people actually recognizing it, still being artful, and still being useful at the same time? Because I think if we keep it in action, I think if it stays in action, it's going to get lost in the noise. I think it's just going to get drowned out. In 1917, it's not done so much for action as to more of the effect of engaging the audience member in the drive of the character, ultimately for drama.
Yeah, I think what works well with 1917 is that the way that they shot it and that whole thing becomes part of the narrative.
Yeah,
it is a part of the movie. It's not just how they shot the movie. It's part of the story.
And I think that's the beauty of it. I think that's why, for a lot of people who are watching 1917, I think that's one of the beauties of it. For people, they're recognizing, like, okay, the long take is not just a gimmick used in this film. It's actually being, it's almost creating a whole nother character that we as the audience are viewing from. Because normally, when you watch a film, you're watching it from third point perspective. You're watching it from the outside, like I said at the beginning, looking in. With what it does with the long take, now you are first perspective. You are walking through, you are, you know, running along with the character, you're finding, you know, how to get out of this, you know, foxhole that's, you know, rigged to blow. You're in the midst of it, and it creates a whole new sense of engagement. And I think for this, with the dramatic effect, it really does create a whole new sense for experiencing movies. But like I said, I hope that it doesn't get that. I hope it doesn't just get turned into something else that we're like, I swear, if the next Marvel movie we see,
oh my god,
they have a long take like this,
you know, it's already in Black Widow.
I
Black Widow,
not.
It's all one shot.
The whole movie.
And the whole shot of Scarlett Johansson's ass.
There you go. See? Now we're
directed by Joss Whedon.
I believe that. I sadly believe that. I really feel like this film is doing something really great. I just feel like we as an audience, we as moviegoers, we as paying moviegoers really need to be mindful of like how much we're putting money into like films that are doing this kind of stuff. Like how much are we allowing ourselves to pay to see this stuff? Because the more and more we pay, the more and more they're going to keep making.
Okay, but like you're not going to know going into a movie if they're going to do a crappy one like take scene.
No, very true. However, it also comes with the mindset of like, all right, if this is a Marvel film and they're going to do this, this, and that, it's like, all right, let's be mindful. Let's like, I don't mind seeing something for the sake of giving it a fair shake. But we know people, you and I, Spencer, we know people who are willing to go see the same movie. And I'm pretty sure Emma knows people who are willing to go see the same movie over and over.
Oh, I do that. Oh,
yeah, just for the sake of like, well, it was cool. I like that one scene and does that over and over. It's like, well, it's like the Joker movie. Like she agrees. I for the life of me,
I haven't seen it,
cannot understand why people are ranting and raving for this film when
11 Oscar nominations.
And for what? Like I said on the we said on the show when it first came out, I'm like, this movie's like, it's not that great. It's irresponsible. And not only that, it's like perpetuating everything that WB has said they're not going to perpetuate.
Yeah.
And it's just, for me, it's not that great of a film. And now we're rewarding it. And it's like, well, why are we rewarding it? Well, because people are still paying into that.
See, that's the part where you plug your own podcast as early screening reviewers and make people listen to you all the time. You're like, see, the solution is listen to this podcast for every movie you go see and for early screenings to always invite you to things.
You're hearing this, Spence? Write it down. We're going to take some notes. I don't know. Like, this is just my own personal thoughts, and I really feel like this movie did an excellent job on the long take. Roger Deakins is fantastic. If you don't know who Roger Deakins is, you're missing out on a lot of great cinematography work that he's done. I mean, honestly, the last thing that I remember he did that was so unique was Blade Runner 2049 back in 2017.
Oh, that was him.
Yeah, he did the cinematography work for that one. He did one of my favorite films, No Country for Old Men. The cinematography in that is unbelievable. Obviously, he did some of the which James Bond movie was that? Was it
Skyfall?
Skyfall. Skyfall is a great film. True Grit is an incredible film. The man has an eye for creating unique and engaging scenes that not only just fit in the background but become a part of the actual scene itself. They become a part of the situation that's happening. And I mean, some of those scenes were, Schofield's like running through that little town.
The burning church scene. I just watched a breakdown of how they did the lighting for that.
Yes.
It's so
curious about that.
Good. It's so, I cannot believe the amount of detail. So the way they started, they made they made a scale model of the whole thing and then created LEDs and just, they essentially made the arc that like a flare would take, and they made sure they knew exactly where every single shadow would fall and where the camera needed to be to follow him and where he needed to be exactly when, okay, well, when it's at the apex, then, you know, the shadow's going to be over here. So he needs to be here and the camera needs to be here. And then they had like, what was it? Like 1,000 light bulbs that created the burning church. And they had to know exactly where those shadows were going to fall and how that was going to do everything. The lighting for that was insanity.
Yeah. And it's cool. Seeing, like, if you're looking at this video, it's a really great video. If you're looking at it, they actually show you their small model and how the light that they have on this little bar, it's like a little track bar. It's like, oh my God, that's exactly what the film looks like. Because you're looking at how these shadows fall and it's like, that's smart. That's really smart.
The other thing they had to do was the camera that they used is brand new. I've already forgotten the name of the company and I feel really bad about it. But basically the company that they used the camera for had just come out with a new camera and they're like, this would be perfect for our movie, except it's too big because these shots are going to be so long that whoever is operating it needs to be able to carry it. So they have 3 prototype cameras and they're the only ones in the world they made this movie, because they contacted the company and they're like, can you make this but smaller? And they kind of were like, they had to go over the cost of it. And they decided, yes, we will give you prototypes. We will let you use these. and then basically probably just promote the shit out of our cameras, tell everybody that you use these, which is why I know what they were. Although, joke's on them, I don't remember the company's name.
Technocrane?
No.
No.
It started with an A.
Oh, the, the ARRI Trinity?
Maybe.
Maybe.
But anyway, so they had to like specially create these little cameras so that they could do exactly every single thing about this movie had to be geared toward what they wanted.
It's called the ARRI Alexa Mini LF.
Yes.
Which is one of, quote, the smallest cameras he ever used, lens-wise. And it was, it was shot in 35mm, 40mm, and 47mm. That's a trip.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I didn't even think about until I was, like, reading articles today is they had to shoot this movie completely in order, which you almost never do, because every single shot had to end perfectly and the next shot had to pick up perfectly. And at the end of the day, they had to shoot it so that the last shot of the day ended exactly where they wanted it. And the next day they had to look at that shot and recreate that so that it would pick up. And so they have to film the entire movie in chronological order, which almost never happens.
This movie is honestly something unique. It's definitely an experience for the eyes and the ears, like on all senses, because this movie, I'm pretty sure if it gets to 4D, I may be willing to go and cough up the money to go see it in 4D.
What?
The D-Box?
The D-Box.
Oh, say D-Box, because otherwise it sounds like you're an insane
Smell-o-vision.
Person. Yeah.
Smell-o-vision. You know, just
one of the ones in the theme park where like there's like misters in front of you and every time you're in the water it like douses you.
Exactly.
So you really smell the bodies.
Yeah. That's exactly what
you smell that decaying horse.
Oh, even worse.
You feel your hand go in the butt.
That's
I hate that part. It was awful.
But I think I would be willing to like cough up the money to see this film in D-Box, like just for the opportunity to see like what the experience would be like, because you already visually see it now, to actually have that rumble and movement and everything. I think I'd probably get like motion sickness, but I would definitely
it.
Yeah, totally worth it. Any issues that you guys had with the film?
I think just that one of those cars showing up and realizing that like that really was the only part of the movie that severely took me out of it.
That was really it
I think. And then I wish I hadn't known. I mean, it didn't really matter in the end, but I wish I hadn't known the cast going into it, because when you get, you know, we got to a certain point and I was like, okay, we haven't seen Benedict Cumberbatch and we haven't seen Richard Madden.
Yeah.
So I know Benedict Cumberbatch is probably that general that they're looking for, or the colonel. And I know Richard Madden's probably going to end up being the brother. And so we get to the end and they make you like, it makes you think that his brother has died. And you're supposed to sit in that feeling that he's died. And all I'm thinking is, we haven't seen Richard Madden yet. He's still alive.
Yeah.
So I wish I hadn't known the cast, but that's just on me. That's not even the movie's fault. Yeah. That's just, I wish I didn't care.
Burden with knowledge.
Exactly.
What about you, Spence? Any other issues with the film? Any thoughts?
Nope.
Wow.
Elaborate as always.
One of the things that I think is really important about this movie, too, is the inclusion of, I feel really bad because I don't know if they ever said his name or if I just missed it, but the Sikh soldier.
They never said his name.
That. You never, like, because generally you see these World War I, World War II movies, and it's all white dudes. Like, somehow only white dudes ever fought in World War I. And so to see a Sikh soldier who gets screen time, he gets more dialogue and more screen time than some of the big-name actors.
Yeah.
And so including him, I felt like, was a really great choice and a really good decision on their part, because there were, you know, tens of thousands of Sikh soldiers that fought in World War I that are never represented in any of these.
Which, by the way, his name is, his actor, his real name is Kitan Majmudar, but he's a British Asian actor. He's also a writer and director, so it's actually really cool to see him. Oh, he was in a couple of, I know some of these films. Interesting. He's the Sikh soldier in that film. Not to mention, there was also a black soldier in the latter scenes. Which was interesting, because that was like out of the blue as well. But,
and yeah, there were like hundreds of thousands of black soldiers that fought in World War I. And again, things that always get left out.
Yeah.
Nobody ever thinks about anybody other than the white people that fought. And they're like, it's Europe. They're all white.
That's true. That's what they've been saying all day. But this film really, this is a really unique film. And the way it wraps it up, I love the fact that when this film wraps up, it wraps up the way it begins, in a very unique way. And it's honestly beautiful. Like, as much as I cringed and stuck my hands into the seats to keep them from grabbing hold of the armrest, because I kept freaking out every time something was happening. I'd be like, oh my God, there's another German soldier. Yeah, I would worry and freak out, and I'm like, oh, he's gonna die. And the film itself is a wonder, and it's a credit to anybody who's ever been a fan of The Long Take, anybody who's ever been a fan of beautiful storytelling of perseverance and determination in war, which, mind you, with all the war films that have been out there, there's a few that really stand out. And obviously, everybody knows Saving Private Ryan, because everybody always talks about it. Tom Hanks, Matt Damon, Vin Diesel.
I've never seen Saving Private Ryan.
Well, I will tell you this, and this is probably my controversial thought for the day. I think this movie is better than Saving Private Ryan.
Ooh, that's fighting words, I think.
Because honestly, this film does a much better, it does much better to the credit of soldiers during that time. It does much better to honor the heart of those that are during that time. Like in Saving Private Ryan, there's a lot of stylized people. There's obviously you got the loud Italian, you have the focused sniper, you have, the elusive, nobody knows who he is, general or captain. There's a lot of there's a lot of tropes, but it's fine because it's a great story. However, it's kind of similar to this. In terms of somebody who's lost a family member is now being sought out, so that way they can make sure they can send a message and, whatever, whatnot. You get that. But in all honesty, I think I actually like this better than Saving Private Ryan. And I don't know how I feel about
that. Have you seen Saving Private Ryan?
No.
Oh, wow. Okay, so neither of us can rebut this.
Well, yeah, no. There you go. I mean, okay, whatever war film have you seen?
The one with you, the horse soldiers one that I was forced to watch.
The War Horse?
Oh my gosh.
No, not the War Horse. It was six something.
War Horses or Horses of War? It was a
Horses of War.
It was a Chris Hemsworth movie. I don't remember.
I got nothing. I got nothing.
I think it was War Horses. I hope it's not War Horses.
Isn't it Six Strong or something like that?
You know what? You're probably right. That sounds like a football movie. But yeah, that was an interesting one.
I saw the one that was was it Unbreakable or Unbelievable or Unsomethingable? About the I think he was a POW in World War II.
Oh, the one that they actually made a sequel to, didn't they?
Did they? Because all my first thought is I don't remember anything about that movie, which I think goes to show how memorable it was.
Yeah, it's the one who's he's got to hold something over his head.
He had that big beam. That's the only thing I remember, and because it was on the poster.
And it was in the trailer. That's the only reason why I remember.
Only thing I remember. But no, this was really good. And I think it also has a very real portrayal of war, both in it's just literally with somebody. But it's not a happy, it's not a happy ending in any way. He at this point has this mission that he's on, and he completes the mission and he gets to it, and he gets to Benedict Cumberbatch and he convinces him to stop. And that's supposed to be it. That's your triumphant, you've saved 1600 people minus however many died in the first wave. You've saved them. And he looks at me and he goes, okay, it's going to be a different order a week from now. They're going to tell us to go. You saved them for now. You saved them for a few days, maybe, but they're all probably still going to die because, he says, this comes down to the last man standing.
Yeah.
Trench warfare was horrendous.
And that's I think, the irony / beauty / real horror of what that war was like, which is, they were getting orders every other, it wasn't even every day. It was as often as I could to change, and just they were all pawns essentially. Yeah. And Emma was saying, he Benedict Cumberbatch essentially tells him that's just the way it is. You tell us this now, something else changes, whatever. You could tell that it was he wanted this war to be over, and these orders were stopping him from ending the war. And you see the bittersweetness in Benedict Cumberbatch's eyes, and you hear it in his voice. And I think that just resonates throughout the remainder of the film, in that, you know what? This in war, nobody wins.
Yeah.
Plain and simple.
And even ending on Richard Madden's character, Blake, finding out that his brother's dead. Like, yeah. He gets all the way to the end just to tell this guy that his brother's dead. And then, you know, the film ends on that shot of him sitting, and he pulls out a picture of his family. And the only thought, so, you know, that's, you know, he turns it over and it, you know, says, come back to us. And it's, you know, a beautiful picture of his wife and children. And you're like, okay, well, he's going to go back. And all I can think is he's going to be severely screwed up if he ever gets home. And he's probably going to die anyway from whatever infection's in his hand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's not surviving that.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of like at the beginning, remembering what was going on at the beginning of the film and just how like unclean they were in terms of like how they took care of themselves. I'm like,
well, yeah. It doesn't even matter for the time period because he stuck his hand instead of a dead person.
No, I'm saying that's what I'm saying.
Who's been dead for a long time?
Like, I'm just wondering like how well other things, like, because if that's how he fixed that, I would be worried. Like, I would be wondering like, okay, I need to get something shot into my hand, or I would be nowadays probably, yeah, whatever. But it just, I don't know. It's one of those mindsets where it's like, yeah, he's definitely going to suffer after this. Like, if this film kept on for another hour, if we were to see what was going on after the fact, I'm pretty sure at one point in time, we're going to come to the point to where he has to get his hand either chopped off or his arm because of the gangrene.
Well, you know what sucks is this is pre-penicillin.
It's very true.
He's having a bad time.
He's just having a bad time.
It gets worse.
And the actor did too, because he got robbed for an Oscar nomination.
Oh my gosh.
I'm upset.
That's for a whole nother episode.
Yeet Joaquin Phoenix out of that category. Put George McKay in.
Did you just say yeet?
I did. Yeet him out of the category.
Well, wrapping this whole thing up, we're going to go ahead and go around the table. Now, obviously, we're going to let Emma go first.
Oh.
And we're going to let her offer her own thoughts. Does the film pass or fail in terms of its entirety of a film? Does it seem cohesive enough? Is it something that is, to you, resolvable? Does it have a great ending? Does it encapsulate the whole story in terms of passing or fail? And out of 5 monocles, how many does it get?
I like how you explained total. To her what passing and fail means. But whenever I asked you when I first came on, you didn't give any type of clear answer.
He said, figure it out.
Exactly.
Total pass on all fronts, 5 out of 5. It has a great story, great beginning, middle, and end. It doesn't have a happy ending. It has a good ending. It just is so... Everything about this movie was so good, and I didn't expect any of it.
Yeah.
It was... And maybe that's why, you know, my thoughts on it are so high, is that I went in with such low expectations that, like, figuring out on the fly, I was like 10 minutes in, I went, I don't know that there's been a cut yet. That's interesting. And, like, figuring all that stuff out on the fly, seeing the movie that way, total pass... 5 out of 5.
Spencer?
Yeah, this movie passes for me. It's really just a well-shot artistic movie. I'm surprised by how much I like just like the visuals that were done with it. And so I'm going to give it like a 3.5.
3.5?
Yeah.
All right. Well,
wow. Wait. What's the other 1.5? Where did that go? What did it get knocked for?
There you go. There you go.
Eddie, what are your...
What? Are we going to skip past this? He was like, you know, I really liked it. 3.5. It got a C?
Yeah, it got a C for me.
Wow.
We would go on for another 20 minutes if I tried to explain why.
Damn, tough
sounds
crowd.
Sounds like we got to get a part 2 going on this one.
No.
The film passes for me. It's definitely a great example of incredible storytelling, as well as a impeccable use of the long take and seeing where it's going in terms of its usages and drama. I appreciate Roger Deakins for everything he's done, and I can't wait to see everything else he has in store. In terms of monocles, I'm going to give this film 4.5 out of 5. This film definitely deserves every single one of those monocles. What?
Not me.
You just saw my face. Yeah. He's at 4.5. Where'd the other half of monocle go? Is it on the editing floor with the other 6 cuts?
It's still stuck in the chair that's still gripped tight because I had a heart attack leaving the theater after that. It's a great movie. Like I said, I'm not a big war film guy, but I can definitely see this film being something I will eventually buy once it comes out and have in my collection. I don't have Saving Private Ryan. I don't have any of those other, like Band of Brothers, any of those other war films, because I just don't like them. But this one, I thoroughly enjoyed. I actually really enjoyed the storyline. I love the just cinematography. It's definitely one of those movies that I'm not going to forget. I'll tell you that much.
I have one last question for you.
Yo.
It's nominated for Best Picture. Do you think it takes it?
Are we talking Oscars?
Yes. Because it just won it at the Golden Globes. Do you think it takes it at the Oscars?
I can say this. I'll say this. It deserves to.
Okay.
I definitely feel like it deserves to with everybody it's up against. There really isn't another film that offers the full amount of expertise that it took to make this film possible, as well as the incredible storytelling that it has. Now, that being said, knowing how political Hollywood is and everything that's going to happen probably with the Oscars, it's probably going to get snubbed.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I want it to win. I in all sincerity, I want this film to win Best Picture.
So. What do you think? Does it have your vote?
I think that anytime I watch the Oscars, they always pick the movies that I don't like. So, like, I like this movie, and they're not going to pick it simply on that fact.
Wow.
Like,
seeing as you so gave ridiculous. It a C, you're saying this one has a chance.
Eddie.
He's like, no, it's going to the Joker.
That's
his vote.
Oh, my gosh.
Literally anything else.
Well, that about wraps up another awesome episode of The Filmlosophers. Remember, you can check us out on all our Facebook pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101, as well as on IG at filmlosophy101 as well. You can also check out our website at www.filmlosophers.com. Emma, we're so glad you were able to join us tonight. This was awesome.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm glad you came. I knew this film really moved you. I saw your tweets, and I'm like, yeah, we got to get her in the studio.
Oh, yeah, I'm just yelling at everybody I know to go see this.
Exactly. I'm doing the same thing. I'm telling, like, I got my folks, I got friends who are asking, like, oh, how was the movie? Like, hey, you just got to go see it. Just go see it. Don't read any just spoilers. Just go see it. So, I mean, yeah, I'm really pushing for this film to kind of get as much attention as possible. It kind of feels a little bit like with Blindspotting, which, have you seen that yet?
No, I know. That's, but no, I have not.
Yeah, we got to talk about that one. This feels like it's getting a little bit behind with, like, being snubbed a lot like that. People are looking at the ones that are more stylized, like Joker and all that. Whatever. So,
I'm glad we can all agree on that one.
Yeah.
But, Emma, where can people find you?
You can find me on all the social media platforms at Emma Skies, EMMASKIES. That's my Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. All the things have the same name. I'm on Twitch. I do Twitch streaming. I try to stream at least 4 times a week. Twitch.tv/EmmaSkies. I'm Emma Skies everywhere. I'm easy to find.
There you go. Well, this has been an awesome conversation. And mind you, if you get a chance, check out this film. It's still in theaters. Check out your local listings, and you won't regret it, without a shadow of a doubt. So, from all of us here at The Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
Oh, and I'm Emma.
Class dismissed.